So find the book of Ruth. Just four chapters immediately after the book of Judges. And we're going to read Ruth chapter 1 now. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." At this they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. There's a hole in my world now. In the place where he was, there's now just nothing. A center of memory and hope and knowledge and affection, which once inhabited the earth, is gone. And only a gap remains. There's nobody now who saw just what he saw, knows what he knew, remembers what he remembered, loves what he loved. A person, an irreplaceable person, has gone. Questions I have can never now get answered. The world is empty. My son is gone. Only a hole remains, a void, a gap, never to be filled. Nicholas Bolterstoff teaches philosophy at Yale. In June 1983, his 25-year-old son, Eric, died in a climbing accident in the Austrian Alps. And in his book, lament for a son, from which those lines I've just read are drawn, he traces the personal anguish of his loss as he struggled to come to terms with it over the following 12 months. Some of you here I know have travelled that pathway of grief too. Some of you are travelling it even now. You're familiar with the stages of grief that he chronicles in his book. You know the numbness of those early days, which others so easily mistake for strength. You know the deep sadness that engulfs the spirit as the initial shock wears off, drowning it in wave upon wave of fathomless depression. You know those irrational feelings of guilt and of anger that surprise and bewilder you. You know the struggle between fantasy and reality. That tormenting expectation that at any moment the door will open and he or she will come back and it will be just as it was before. You know the ache and the tears that find no relief. You know the doubt, the questions that seem to find no answer. You know the regret, the yearning for just one more opportunity, perhaps to say sorry, perhaps to say thank you, perhaps simply to say goodbye. You know the sense of isolation too, which loss brings. The impossibility of inviting anybody else, no matter how caring and sensitive, into your private hell. And you know the exasperating inadequacy of well-meant but cheap platitudes. I know how you're feeling, they say, but they don't. It's not so bad, they say, when you are screaming for somebody to articulate just how appallingly, indescribably bad it really is. You have good memories. But you don't want memories. Memories are but dust and ashes in the mouth. Memories are but the trigger of fresh pain, a phrase of music, a fragrance in the air, a passing likeness in the crowd. Such are unexpected, such insignificant souvenirs, yet each one sufficient to plunge your soul down fresh cataracts of dark despair. You know it is, if you have walked that way. There's a hole in the world now. Void, a gap. And for those who loved the person that once filled that gap, the hole that is thus left passes right through the heart with savage laceration. I say, if you have passed that way, then you especially will have no difficulty engaging with the story of Ruth. And particularly with this first chapter of it. For it too is a story of bereavement. Two women thrown by the death of their loved ones into a situation of utter hopelessness. Yet it's important to remember, even from the beginning, this is a book of hope. As we shall see in later weeks, this is a book that insists God is at work, even in these times of personal tragedy when he seems most absent. The valley of the shadow of death may be a formidably dreadful place, but the book of Ruth says it can be crossed without fear because God is with us, even when we cannot feel his presence or trace his hand. He is there. We can trust his sovereign purpose, working all things together for good, even in bereavement. So with that in mind, let's not be afraid to launch into a story of grief. The opening lines set the stage for this domestic tragedy. In the days when the judges ruled, the story begins. The narrator needs say no more for any Jewish reader to picture the moral decadence of the world thus identified. If you are not familiar with it, read the chapters 19 to 21 of the book of Judges, the final chapters of Judges, immediately before this book of Ruth. You will learn there of the brutal gang rape of an innocent young girl left dead on a doorstep. You'll learn too of the internecine feuding which resulted from that crime and the inability of society to handle it any other way. You'll read of the criminality and the anarchy that was characteristic of those days of the Judges. Because, as the writer of Judges comments, there was no king in the land, and therefore everybody did just what they liked. It would have been a tough world at the best of times. But to that scene of violence and brutality, our narrator also adds a word of cruelty in providence. It wasn't just the day when the judges ruled. There was a famine in the land, too, to make it worse. Was this famine a judgment for God upon the people's moral degeneracy? Can't help suspecting our narrator intends us to draw some such inference. For it is in Bethlehem his story is set. And Bethlehem is the very place from which the victim of that vicious gang rape I just mentioned came in Judges 19. It is the tribe of Judah who put their hand first to the violence, to the vigilante violence that resulted from that crime. What's more, of course, ironically, Bethlehem in Hebrew means the house of bread. There was no bread then in the house of bread, reads our text. Is it any wonder, in a world when the judges rule, or rather, failed to do so. Still, at least, as our narrator reminds us, Bethlehem was a city of Judah within the boundaries of the land which God had given to his chosen people. So once again, one cannot help, I think, entertain at least the suspicion that he regarded the decision of Elimelech under the pressure of this economic austerity to become an emigre, to become a refugee in, of all places, Moab. Such a decision, I think, our narrator must have regarded as ill-judged. For they were idolatrous pagans in Moab, and they had never made any secret of their enmity towards the people of God. Moab was hardly a place where any self-respecting Jew would choose to live. No Moabite shall ever enter the Lord's assembly, ruled Moses in Deuteronomy 23. Do not seek peace or good relations with the Moabites as long as you live. Oh, technically it wasn't illegal to go and move to Moab, but it was certainly no great act of faith either. Especially since he took with him two, presumably, teenage sons. What Jewish girls were they going to find to date in Moab? Is it any surprise that we discover later they have married two local Moabite women? Elimelech as good as invited such a turn of events. Like many in Israel at this time, I suspect Elimelech and his sons sat pretty loose to the religion of their forefathers. Maybe not downright apostates, but they were very far from being spiritual heroes. And maybe it's as if to confirm our suspicion in this regard that a narrator goes on to record the premature death, not just of Elimelech himself, but of his sons as well. He leaves us to surmise whether this is just an unfortunate coincidence, or one more stroke of divine judgment. Anyway, with these men untimely removed, the stage is cleared for what to Jewish ears must have been a rather unexpected and novel twist to this story. But unlike so many of those militaristic adventures which were told about the days of the judges by the ancient Jews, the two leading characters of this will be women. And women, mark you, with a good deal more spirituality in their little finger than most of the men of that period seem to possess in their whole bodies. Look first with me at Naomi, Elimelech's widow. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. with her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Perhaps she'd always been a reluctant emigre. At the very least, the death of her husband and of her sons has resulted in Naomi's rediscovery of her spiritual roots. Moab had been a disaster. She had lost everything, not even a grandchild to show for all those empty years. "It's time to go back," she says. "At least we hear the famine has broken. That's one piece of good news. Let's pretend these last 10 years have never happened. Let's try to salvage something out of the appalling misery of it all." But then as she sets on her way, she reflects a little. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another." Many commentators interpret these words as a gesture of exceptional generosity in the face of her personal grief. And to some extent, of course, they were. She's bidding farewell here to the only social support she has left for her in her widowed state. It says much, I think, for Naomi's character that she's capable of such a gesture. Indeed, it says even more for her character that her daughters-in-law are so reluctant to take advantage of her offer. "We will go back with you to your people," they say. Perhaps in part it's their solidarity in grief that has drawn them together. But one has to say bereavement doesn't always have that effect. For we do grieve in different ways, and sometimes that means the experience of loss has the effect of distancing us from other family members rather than drawing us closer. And in any case, the relationship between a mother-in-law and her son's wives is not renowned for its easy affection, is it? Now, I think Naomi must have been, at least in the days before her husband's death, a woman of great kindness and affection and graciousness. Fully living up to her name, Naomi, as the margin tells us, means pleasant. And no doubt her suggestion that Ruth and Orpah should return home is one more expression of that graciousness. Yet I can't help suspecting that our narrator intends us to catch an ironic, perhaps even a sarcastic edge to her tone, when in verse 8 she says, "May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." There's a slight emphasis there, as if to detect the unspoken implication. God could take a lesson out of the book of you two. Pagans though you are by background, you've treated me a lot better than he has. I only hope he blesses you for your kindness in a way he certainly has not blessed me for my kindness. For he has left me without rest, without a home, without a husband to my name, and no prospect of ever finding one. "Now don't stick with me," she said. "I'm a loser. Return home, my daughters. Why come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who become your husbands? I'm too old to have another husband. Return home. Even if there was still hope for me, would you wait until my sons had grown so you could marry them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you. The Lord's hand has gone out against me. I'm a loser. I'm a jinx. The Lord's curse is upon me. I don't know why. Things will only get worse for you then if you come home with me. After all, what are you, young Moabite women? Back where I come from, you'll be the victims of all kinds of racial discrimination and sexual harassment. I know what it's like in Bethlehem these days. It's a place where it's not safe for a woman to walk alone at night. The only hope of survival in that jungle, if you're a woman, is to have a husband to protect and provide for you. And what hope is that for you? That is there for you. No Jew is going to take one of those despised Moabites to wife in his own country. Maybe if I had some sons, they'd do the decent thing and marry you, as sometimes was the custom in those days. But I haven't got any, nor any prospect of getting any, and even if I did, you'd be way past marriageable age by the time they were grown up. No, it's pointless. It's hopeless. There's no reason for you to come back with me. Your future lies in Moab. There among your own people you'll find other husbands and rebuild your lives. In Judah there is no hope for any of us. Least of all for me. Because the Lord's hand has gone out against me. So maybe then those commentators are right to suggest that it was not so much heroic generosity on Naomi's part that moved her to offer these two women the freedom to return to Moab, so much as resigned despair. A hopelessness so abject it has almost become masochistic in its intensity. That certainly seems to be the mood of the greeting she offers the women in Bethlehem when she eventually gets back, doesn't it? "Don't call me Naomi," she says. "Call me Mara." As one translator tried to anglicize the pun, "Don't call me sweetheart, call me sour." "The Lord Almighty has made my life bitter. I went away full. I have come back empty. There is a hole in my life now. The Lord has afflicted me. He has brought this misfortune upon me. Here is a woman, I say, whom grief has taken beyond range of hope. Though kindly and gracious by nature, it has plunged her into depths of uncharacteristic melancholy and self-pity." Grief does that to people. Listen to Professor Walterstorff again. "I have become an alien in this world. Shyly I touch it as if it were no longer mine. I don't belong anymore. For the lines of memory all lead now into a place of cold, inky black. I buried myself that warm June day. It was me those gardeners lowered on squeaking straps into that hot, dry hole. It was me over whom they slid that heavy slab. It was me on whom we shoveled dirt. It was me we left behind. Sometimes I think I shall never be happy again." What do we learn from Ruth chapter 1? The first thing we learn is a lesson about grieving. Some commentators note this negative mood which dominates Naomi's dialogue in this chapter, and they are disposed to criticize her for it. After all, they say, Ruth was grieving too, wasn't she? But she clearly found a much more positive frame of mind in which to come to terms with her loss. Surely our author intends to disparage Naomi by comparison with her. Her bleak despair is not the despair of faith, and it surely can't be right to hurl blame upon God in the way she so continually does. But personally, I doubt very much whether the narrator intends us to respond in that critical way to Naomi's example. Just like the book of Job, just like that psalm we read earlier in our service, the Bible is full of encouragements to empathize with the emotional devastation which bereavement, for instance, brings in its wake. Of course, Naomi blames God. Many grief-stricken souls blame God. Is he not the sovereign ruler of our human affairs? Are not life and death in his gift? No, there is no impiety in such emotional honesty. God invites us to be real with him about our feelings in this matter. And if you have any doubts on that score, remember again the cry of one who in his hour of grief screamed in identification with suffering innocents the world over, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When we are bewildered by God's dealings with us, when we feel cheated or even angered by the cruelty of his providence, it's important for us to find the courage to tell him so. Bottling up our rage can only intensify our depression. People often say to me, you know, "I ought not to feel like this. This anger, this depression, this hate even, I ought not to feel it." Well, quite frankly, the word "ought" is not a helpful word to use in the context of our emotional life. For our feelings are nowhere near as responsive to the dictates of our will as our actions are. There's a very real sense in which you cannot help how you feel sometimes. To be ashamed of your feelings is a bit like being ashamed of your appearance. There's only a limited amount you can do to change the way you look. And there's only a very limited amount you can do to change the way you feel. The appropriate response to negative feelings is not guilt, therefore, but acceptance. Face up to how you feel. Admit it to yourself, and admit it to God too. For refusing to do so will simply condemn us to a vicious cycle of accumulated inner grievance from which there is no escape. I think I've mentioned before the story that occurs the incident that occurs in Peter de Vries' novel, The Blood of the Lamb. Always moved me intensely since I first read it. The main character of that book has a daughter who, on the very day of her 12th birthday, dies of leukemia. And the father finds himself, on hearing this dreadful news, outside a church, still holding the birthday cake which he had been taking to the hospital in order to inject some little happiness into the special day of this special girl. He looks up, and there on the wall of the church is a crucifix. And suddenly he explodes with rage, and he hurls the birthday cake. When I first read that, I remember I found it offensive, blasphemous. Perhaps, in some ways, it was. And yet, on deeper reflection, I realize now there is a sense in which that is precisely what Jesus is on the cross for. He is a symbol of anger. The passionate anger of God against the evil of this broken, sinful world. He is a symbol of that divine anger venting itself safely, healingly, in a gigantic catharsis of the divine passion. God reconciles himself to this sinful world, expressing his anger against it on the cross. That's how God handles his feelings. When we feel angry, as in a situation of bereavement, we need to remember God himself is no stranger to that emotion. He has lost one he loves too. He doesn't mind us expressing our indignation. He knows we need to get that feeling off our chest if we are to be reconciled. He will not blame us for wallowing in a little self-pity. In some measure, grief is always self-pity. It is our sense of personal loss we are confessing. Naomi's grief will not last forever. This story will have a happy ending, remember that. But while it does last, there is nothing in biblical religion that requires her to pretend she feels other than she does. And there is every encouragement in biblical religion to articulate her sorrow in God's presence. There is a lesson here about grieving. Yet, as I say, it's important to remember that this scene of tragedy, which the narrator presents in Acts 1, is nevertheless the beginning of a story of hope. And there is a sign of hope in this very chapter, albeit unrecognized by Naomi at this stage in the story. Unexpected, unrecognized perhaps by all of us, even as we read it. But it is there. And to identify it, we need to look at this other leading lady, Ruth. Verse 14. At this they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung. Now that decision to cling rather than to kiss her goodbye. So it arrived so early in the plot is in many respects the climax of this whole story. For events will prove, as we shall discover in later weeks, that this decision on Ruth's part is the turning point, not only of her own fate and the fate of Naomi, it is the turning point for the nation of Israel. Indeed, it is not too much to say that God's eternal plan of salvation for the world hinged in some respects on this apparent minor decision on the part of an insignificant Moabite widow. From the stream of events which this decision has set in motion, King David, and ultimately, Christ. When you look at it that way, Ruth 1, verse 16 and 17 deserves underlining in red ink. Why did she refuse to go home? Naomi certainly tried to persuade her, didn't she? But the force of her logic made not the slightest dent in Ruth's resolution. Verse 18, when Naomi realized Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her, or more literally, she refrained from speaking to her, because once again, the tone of the Hebrew suggests to me not so much gratitude at this demonstration of fidelity on Ruth's part, but rather the sullen, exasperated silence of a woman whose ability to fight, to argue, has just been drained to zero. Naomi is beyond caring. She doesn't really believe that this grand gesture will make any difference to her situation. It's utter folly. It doesn't dispel her darkness. And rationally speaking, Naomi is right to so judge. For Ruth had every reason, every excuse, every justification for going back to the familiar world of her own people. Her sister-in-law Orpah had chosen to do so. It would be sensible, the expected thing for her to do the same. Nobody could possibly blame her. And yet she opts to stay with Naomi, knowing that in all probability, she is opting for a life of poverty, a life of singleness, a life of exile. Why? What earth motivates her to do such an extravagant thing? Clearly, the author feels the clue lies in her words here, in verses 16 and 17. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. What do you think those words imply? Well, at the very least, surely, they imply that Ruth had become a believer in the God of the Bible, didn't they? She may have been a Moabitess by race, but her faith was now the faith of a Hebrew. Again, that must be a testimony, surely, to Naomi's godly example. It's hard to believe Ruth had learned much of biblical religion from her husband or her father-in-law. There is, in fact, in a rather interesting double entendre in the way the narrator, in these closing verses, constantly repeats that verb, to return. It occurs even more often in the Hebrew than it seems to do in translation here. Because in the Hebrew, that word return not only means to go back, it's often used in the sense of to repent or to convert, to turn to the God of the Bible. And maybe it's in that sense sometimes he means it here. For Ruth is not returning to Bethlehem in the way Naomi was. She'd never been there before. Yet the Hebrew text, for instance in verse 22, literally says, Naomi returned and Ruth returned. I can't help wondering if our author isn't exploiting that second metaphorical sense of the word there. For Ruth, in accompanying Naomi back to Bethlehem, is making a statement of personal faith. Your God will be my God. This desire not to identify any longer with the pagan idols of her people is a major factor in her choice. Her commitment to Naomi is a step of faith. Her return to Bethlehem is a baptism. And yet, I'm sure there is a little more to it, even than that. Just look again at the form of Ruth's words here. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. Now, this is not just a simple affirmation of determination. Ruth is quite deliberately here casting her decision in the form of a covenant promise. That invocation of a curse upon herself, should she break her word, is characteristic of such covenants in the ancient world. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I don't do as I say. Such a form of words in the ancient world had the uncompromising force of a legal contract, or maybe even of a marriage vow. There is something rather similar to a marriage vow here in what she says, isn't there? For better, for worse. Till death us do part. Indeed, even more remarkable than the covenant form is the remarkable similarity, and the quite intentional similarity, between this covenant promise which Ruth makes to Naomi and the covenant promises which God had made to Israel. Again and again in these early chapters of the book of the Bible, of the Bible, we find God saying to Israel, "My presence will go with you. I will go with you." And what do we find Ruth saying to Naomi? Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Again and again in these early chapters, we read God saying to Israel, "I will be your God. You will be my people." And what does Ruth say to Naomi? "Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God." The parallels are so conspicuous, they must surely be deliberate. Why does Ruth do this? Why does she bind herself so irrevocably, so solemnly to this other woman, in the form of words which amounts to a divine covenant and consciously reflects the divine covenant? But I think the only conclusion we can draw, the conclusion the author is inviting us to draw, is this. That Ruth, though she is such a new believer in the God of Israel, has already learned that the primary moral response this God demands of the people is a covenant love like his own. The primary moral response this God requires of his people is a covenant love like his own. A covenant love evidenced not just by the fidelity of their relationship with him, but also by the fidelity of their relationship with one another. This, you see, is the very thing that was breaking down in the time of the judges. Hosea would complain of a later generation, "There is no faithfulness. There is no covenant love. There is no knowledge of God in the land. There is only cursing and lying and murder and stealing and adultery. They break all bounds. Bloodshed follows bloodshed," he says. "And because of this, the land mourns. And those that live in it waste away." Hosea there is describing 8th century Israel, but he could just as well have been describing the period of the judges. Israel in these days was sinking in a sea of moral anarchy. And at the root of it was a collapse of covenant love in personal relationships. People just did not care about one another anymore. People just did not trust one another anymore. There was no faithfulness, no covenant love, no knowledge of God in the land. God had promised Israel his covenant love. But Israel, in her sinful rebelliousness, saw nothing to be gained by demonstrating that kind of sacrificial love in her own relationships to one another. And so she was reaping the judgment of God upon her callousness and her selfishness, her anarchistic individualism. The land mourned. There was no bread in the house of bread. Yet here in a private exchange between two apparently insignificant women, a different pattern, a different paradigm of human relationship is being shaped. Ruth, the pagan convert, is showing a true-born Jewess the kind of commitment, the kind of sacrificial commitment God requires of his people when it comes to personal relationships. She's showing her the meaning of covenant love. Orpah, her sister-in-law, was not a particularly bad person for failing to pledge the same devotion to Naomi. She simply demonstrates here that she wasn't a believer. She couldn't take this step of faith. Covenant love was far too sacrificial a gesture for her. And because she had not the faith, she would not experience the blessing of the covenant God in her life, as Ruth was subsequently. That's the lesson our author wants us to draw from it. When we human beings abandon costly love for God and neighbor, we make a desert around us. A desert in which often the weak and the vulnerable, like Naomi, suffer most, even though they may be least guilty. Yet when just one individual, one solitary individual, discovers the faith to make costly sacrifices, the kind of costly sacrifice which love for God and neighbor demands, then the judgment begins to lift. The desert begins to bloom. Despair begins to give way to hope. Ruth's decision to cling to Naomi is the hinge not only of our own destiny, but of the destiny of Israel and of the world. God took her act of covenant love and embedded it in his great cosmic purpose. Do you notice that subtle little signal which the author so cleverly puts at the very end of Act 1? Of his story, just to hint to us that we are standing on the watershed. Naomi returns from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter, and they arrive in Bethlehem as the barley harvest is just beginning. Well, well, well. So there is bread in the house of bread again. And it starts to be reaped just as Ruth arrives. What a thing. What do you learn from this story? You learn a lesson about grieving from Naomi, yes, and it's an important lesson. But we learn from this story an even more important lesson. We learn a lesson about loving. See, just as in the time of the Judges, relationships are finding it tough going in our modern world, aren't they? Christopher Lash, in his book, The Culture of Narcissus, writes, "Our society has made lasting friendships and marriages increasingly difficult to achieve. Social life has become more and more warlike. Personal relationships have taken on the character of combat. Some dignify the combat by offering courses in assertiveness training. Others celebrate the impermanent attachments that result with slogans like the open marriage. But in doing so, they merely intensify the pervasive dissatisfaction with the quality of human relationships, which is at the heart of our problem. We live, like Ruth in the days of Judges, in days when rape has become commonplace, when a two-year-old toddler can be murdered by other children. We live in days when violence stalks our street at night, when no woman can safely walk at night. Days of ethnic tension and domestic violence. Is it any wonder we suffer economic problems? What is a recession if it isn't the equivalent in a capitalist society for a famine in an agrarian one. Now, the reason for our economic problems lies not in our stars, still less in the Bundesbank. It lies in ourselves. We are not the victims of fate. This is the judicial chastening of God. There is no faithfulness. There is no covenant love. There is no knowledge of God in the land. Therefore the land mourns. But here's the encouragement of this story. You and I can do something about it. We don't have to shrug our shoulders with helplessness. We don't have to walk the corridors of power to turn the tide for our society. This book of Ruth assures us a single act of heroic love on the part of an insignificant, ethnically alien widow woman was the hinge to Israel's future blessing. Why should it not be the same for us? This world of ours desperately needs to see the way Christians love each other. There's nothing we can do for this sin-sick world more powerful than, like Ruth, to demonstrate to one another and to others what covenant love is like. Some of us here are single. Some of us are divorced. Some of us, like Ruth, are bereaved. This story has special relevance to you. For I know you struggle with loneliness. Maybe, like Naomi, you resent the way God has dealt with you. Who can blame you for doing so? It's understandable. You wouldn't be human if you didn't feel that. But we do not have to wallow in self-pity indefinitely. There is an alternative response, and Ruth does illustrate it, though it requires faith and sacrifice. This story insists it is the pathway out of bitterness and into blessing. Ruth, dare I say, Ruth here made singleness not her fate, but her choice. She made of a cruel providence an opportunity to love. You don't have to believe, you see, the gold blend advent. Romance and marriage are not the only context in which it is possible to give and receive real love in this world. There are countless people in this world who need to be loved and will never find it through marriage. Ruth committed herself in covenant love, not to a husband, but to a widow. Her devotion, her energy, would be turned to serving and caring for this lonely, vulnerable person, in desperate need of such support. Have you any idea how many lonely and desperate people there are who need similar support? God is looking today for Ruth. People who are prepared to sacrifice their desire for self-fulfillment for the sake of others. And single folk have something very special to offer in that. Women have something very special to offer in that. But all of us need to learn it. Here's a woman who abandons her career in order to care for an elderly relative. Is that not covenant love? Here's a man who turns down much desired promotion in order to have more time to spend with his growing kids. Is that not covenant love? Here's a student who surrenders his place in the first 11 in order to take a handicapped person to McDonald's on Saturday afternoon. Is that not covenant love? Here is a nurse who accepts her singleness as the price of her calling to care for AIDS victims in Uganda. Is that not covenant love? Here are a couple who accept their childlessness as an opportunity to foster the orphaned, the abused, the deserted kids of inner city Liverpool. Is that not covenant love? Here's just anybody. Any old person who in the midst of a demanding, pressured life regularly makes space so that they can be reliably and consistently available to their friends when they need a shoulder to cry. Is that not covenant love? It's in very short supply today and getting short. When we have to make choices, decisions about the direction of our life, decisions about our priorities in life, remember Ruth. What God demands as the primary moral response of his is covenant love. Not just in their fidelity to him, but in their personal relationships with one another. Don't let anybody tell you it doesn't count. We have it on the authority of the Master himself. Not a cup of water, not a cup of water given to the least of these little ones, will lose its reward. What you and I do, you see, in the world of our personal relationship matters. Matters on a scale far beyond what we perhaps imagine. Far beyond the scale of our petty lives, even. What to the eye of unbelief may seem like a pointless, sacrificial gesture may in God's eye be the crucial event of his divine plan for the world. Here is a woman, Ruth, who leaves the security of her homeland in order to love an embittered old lady. Here is a Christ who leaves the glory of heaven to love a sinful world. Empty gestures? Now these are the things upon which the fate of the world is decided. Upon such individual acts of moral heroism, the very destiny of our world is hinged. That's what Ruth tells us. It matters that little people love, and they change the world when they do. It's not for nothing that courageous Ruth is listed in the Bible among the honored ancestors of God's Messiah. And it is not for nothing that that same Messiah tells us to take up our cross and follow him. This is my command, he says. Love each other as I have loved you. Demonstrate in your personal relationships the quality of covenant love God has demonstrated to you in the blood of the cross. Love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than that he lay down his life for his friends. And you are my friend. Let us pray together.